if you look at that trail today, you would say, you don't want to run the Iditarod across that. But what you see today isn't what you're going to see on race day.
The Iditarod start will stay in Willow. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, February 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a move to shift the balance on the state council that nominates Alaska judges.
They can, with their vote, choose people who think the way they think.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
There's a good feeling you get when you give, and each year more Alaskans are supporting things they love when they file online for their PFD. Alaskans like you donated $2.5 million last year to strengthen education, help families in need of food and shelter, and protect the most vulnerable among us. You even shared your permanent fund dividends with public radio to keep quality programming alive and well. This year, the PFD is expected to be a lot bigger. So come on, love Alaska. Pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
The Iditarod Sled Dog Race will start from Willow as planned. The Iditarod Trail Committee has been weighing moving the race start to Fairbanks in the last week because of low snow and icy conditions on the 65 miles of trail between Willow and Squintna. Iditarod Trail Committee Executive Director Stan Hooley says it wasn't a tough decision to keep the start in Willow after race staff had a plan to improve the trail.
You know, no one would look at the trail as it exists today out of Willow to Squintna and say, gee, let's run the Iditarod on this. It's not good right now, but we've got the ability to use heavy equipment to groom and literally build a highway, and that I think everybody feels pretty good about.
Palmer-based Cruise Construction, a company that has experience building ice roads, has offered to groom the trail with a piston bully snowcat and other specialized equipment. Hooley says without that help, the race start would have likely moved to Fairbanks. He says given what the equipment can do, he doesn't think there's any risk to sticking with the traditional route.
To be able to change the consistency of that ice into something that resembles snow and a safe trail, I think is something we're confident we can do and that people will be happy with.
Hooley says the trail will be in good shape in time for the Willow start on March 3rd. 70 mushers are signed up to make the run to Nome. A group of Republican state senators want to change the makeup of a commission tasked with vetting judges for the governor. But some critics worry that could shift the balance of the judicial system itself. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
Since statehood, the Alaska Judicial Council has been made up of three attorneys, three public members, and the Chief Justice of the state Supreme Court. The attorneys are there to give input on how well judicial candidates understand the law, while the public members offer a perspective on what the state should want from its judges. Now, Senator Pete Kelly wants public members to outnumber lawyers 2-1. The Fairbanks Republican believes the Constitution should be amended for two reasons. One, the current configuration doesn't allow for much regional diversity because most attorneys don't live in rural areas. Kelly read from the membership roster at a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on Friday.
It reads like an urban Alaskan phone book. Attorney members, Ketchikan, Juneau, Fairbanks, Anchorage.
Kelly's second qualm is that when the public members and attorney members are split, the Chief Justice has sided with the attorneys in a little over half those cases. He thinks that creates a conflict of interest for the Chief Justice.
They can, with their vote, choose people who think the way they think. And so you have a molding of the potential molding of the Supreme Court by members of the Supreme Court. It puts them in an incredible position of power.
Over the past 30 years, there have only been 15 situations where the public members and the attorneys have been divided on a judicial candidate. That's out of more than 1,000 votes. But Senator Liesl McGuire, an Anchorage Republican, says those instances can still spark controversy.
It doesn't sit well with the public, and it has created tremendous acrimony.
Because the Judicial Council has so much influence over which judges the governor appoints, it's been somewhat of a lightning rod in recent years. In 2009, two applicants for judicial posts tried suing the state because they took issue with the nominating process. In 2012, a conservative advocacy group filed a complaint against the council, arguing that the council should not be able to campaign on behalf of judges. Last year, Senator Pete Kelly introduced a separate bill to prevent the Judicial Council from doing just that. During the Senate hearing, McGuire noted that making changes to Judicial Council policy can be a sensitive prospect, but she thinks updating that policy could help prevent the state from switching to a system where judges are elected.
When we do that, it's not an attack.
But some Democrats worry it might be. Senator Bill Willikowski sees it as part of a crusade to get a more socially conservative judiciary. He likens the measure to Franklin D. Roosevelt's attempt to pack the Supreme Court during his presidency. Senator Hollis French doesn't think the argument for the amendment holds up either. He says Alaska has a strong judiciary, and he doesn't see good evidence for changing it.
But it may be that certain activist groups out in the public are unhappy with the way our Constitution is interpreted, and they want to tip the scales in their favor.
Because Kelly's measure would amend the Constitution, it needs support from two-thirds of the legislature and a majority of Alaska voters. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Alaska's largest Native organization is challenging a Southeast group to lead the regional campaign to regain federal voting rights protections. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Alaska Federation of Natives is already campaigning to restore voting protections struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court last year. Speaking at a Native Issues Forum in Juneau, President Julie Kitka asked for regional help.
You have the history in our Native community on helping, leading us to getting us to the right to vote on that. And we need letters, opinion pieces. We need the full weight of the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood.
The organizations have a 100-year history of advocating for Alaska Native rights, including voting. The Brotherhood and Sisterhood have about 20 local chapters called camps, based mostly in Southeast. ANB Regional President Bill Martin says the organizations are behind the effort.
At our ANB convention in Yakutat in October, we passed a resolution. And we'll be there again this year, both the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Alaska Native Sisterhood, to voice our objection.
The Federal Voting Rights Act used to require Alaska and some southern states to get pre-approval for redistricting plans. That led officials to set some election district boundaries so they include significant Native populations. That's the part of the act the U.S. Supreme Court struck down. Bipartisan legislation proposed in January would restore some of those provisions. AFN's Kitka says a coalition of Latino, African American, Asian American, and other civil rights groups is backing the proposed amendment. But she says it won't do any good here.
At this time, we're not included in that amendment. In fact, Native Americans get no protections under the formula that they use, and we calculate it would probably cost us $800,000 to file lawsuits enough to trigger for us to be considered under that federal mechanism.
That's why her organization is seeking statewide support for changes to the act that would include Alaska Natives. The Supreme Court ruling came as Alaska's redistricting board shuffled election boundaries. The plan used for the 2012 elections was a factor in the defeat of Southeast's two incumbent Tlingit lawmakers, and that came before the court ruling. The plan has since undergone minor changes, but none expected to help either win back seats. Kitka says restoring some of the Voting Rights Act struck down provisions would help more people cast ballots.
Over the last few years, we've seen increasing efforts to try to really depress people voting as people try to angle for this campaign or that campaign. And so from our vantage point, it's critically important that we make sure that we have that rock-solid foundation protection of our voting rights.
The High Court ruled redistricting preclearance was based on a history of discrimination that no longer exists. Alaska's redistricting board agreed, saying changes in Native voting power have more to do with population growth and rural-urban shifts than redrawing election boundaries. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
Recent court challenges to state bans on same-sex marriage have, in several cases, resulted in judges striking down the laws, such as last week in Virginia. Alaska has a constitutional amendment that bans same-sex marriage, and state attorneys have filed support briefs for states fighting to preserve their own constitutional bans. One such case in Nevada changed recently when the attorney general there said they would back away from the suit after it appeared likely to be appealed to the Ninth Circuit. Alaska has filed an amicus brief supporting Nevada's ban. Alaska's Attorney General Michael Garrity says even though Nevada officials are abandoning the case, the Alaska brief will remain.
There are a number of challenges going on across the country, and we'll continue to support those briefs in those states that are fighting to preserve their own constitutional provisions. And so that's what we'll continue to do. I don't know what's going to happen to the case, the specific case, since Nevada has elected to let it drop. But there are other cases, and it will continue to percolate through the federal courts.
Garrity says he won't speculate about whether Alaska's ban will survive a future challenge. Alaska's voters approved a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage in 1998. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, global warming creates new habitat for geese in the Arctic.
Is there sort of a march of this habitat inland, or do we reach a point at which it can't extend any further inland?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com. And by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
A woman accused of murdering a man in Pennsylvania says she killed dozens of others in four states, including Alaska. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the case involves allegations of serial killing and Satanism.
Miranda Barber and her husband are charged with the November 2013 Pennsylvania stabbing and strangling death of a man who responded to her companionship ad on Craigslist. Sunbury, Pennsylvania Daily Item reporter Francis Scarsella says the 19-year-old Barber contacted him and requested an interview. Scarsella says he met with Barber in prison last week, where she told him she started killing while growing up in Alaska.
She came from Alaska, and when she started to, you know, speak to me about, you know, she said she did this before. And when she said that, you know, she said the majority of what she did was up there in Alaska.
Barber told Scarsella she got into Satanism at age 13, carrying out her first killing with the leader of a cult, adding that she had been sexually abused as a child and killed people who did bad things. Scarsella says Barber's Facebook page says she's from North Pole, but she referenced being in other communities in the interview.
She mentioned Wasilla, Nome, Anchorage, Palmer, and Big Lake.
The Daily Item reports that Barber provided few details about her murders, only saying she stopped counting at 22 and that the majority occurred in Alaska. Scarsella says Barber repeatedly made references to the Valley.
And she said that that's where a lot of the satanic stuff was. She just said that she was part of a satanic cult and she was high on the panel.
Barber claims to have left Alaska at age 16 and moved to the lower 48, where she continued killing in Texas, North Carolina, and California. Scarsella describes her statements as believable.
She sounded very calm, cool, and collective, so she said it very matter-of-factly.
Sunbury, Pennsylvania Police Chief Steve Mazzeo says Barber's attorney has refused to let her talk to law enforcement, but they are taking her comments to the media seriously.
That was reported in our local newspaper. Our detectives have liaison with the local county prison authorities and are determining what information is available to us that we may then pass on to other agencies.
Chief Mazzeo says he can't discuss details of a murder investigation, but confirms it is being expanded.
Some information has been received, and we are passing it on to appropriate county, state, and federal agencies who may be able to further the validity or the non-validity of the allegations that may have occurred in their jurisdictions.
North Pole and Fairbanks police chiefs and the FBI in Alaska were unavailable for comment because of the President's Day holiday. State Trooper spokeswoman Megan Peters says they have received information about the alleged Alaska connection.
And we will work with other authorities as appropriate, and if any leads do present themselves, we'll take necessary action.
Peter says she does not have any information on whether Barber's claims line up with unsolved deaths during the time span she alleges to have killed in Alaska. Daily Item reporter Francis Scarsella is scheduled to speak with Miranda Barber again Thursday. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A legislative proposal creating a path for qualified village public safety officers to carry firearms has cleared another hurdle. SB 98 was passed on Thursday by the Senate Community and Regional Affairs Committee, but some serious concerns were raised about the proposal. KNOM's Zachariah Hughes reports.
A draft proposal outlines a funding structure for 20 VPSOs a year to train at the Police Academy in Sitka. The native corporations and boroughs that employ VPSOs would have final say over whether they wanted approved officers to carry firearms. Pushback came from current and former law enforcement members. Testifying during public comment, Sergeant Chris Gifford with the Juneau Police Department worried that the regiment for training VPSOs is insufficient for authorizing them to use deadly force.
My concern is that an inadequate selection process and an inadequate level of training will amount to increased liability to the corporations who employ the VPSOs. More importantly, rural Alaskans will be provided for with what will be, with all intents and purposes, a police officer, but is not one hired to the standards and trained to the standards of other police officers in the state. This bill can be improved upon.
Over the phone, Charles Kamai Jr., a VPSO program coordinator, spoke on behalf of the Kodiak Area Native Association. Kamai says he understands the realities of rural violence, but says his group has reservations about endorsing the bill before a more comprehensive candidate screening system is in place.
We respectfully request that this bill not be moved until and unless it includes provisions for an expanded vetting process, which includes psychological assessments of VPSOs who are under consideration for arming.
Jody Potts works for the Tanana Chiefs Conference and spent years as a VPSO. She says that while the TCC supports the bill, they too want a better pre-hire screening process that evaluates mental fitness of potential VPSOs. Criticism of SB 98 and its counterpart in the House has been sparse and focused almost exclusively on questions over whether the men and women who serve as VPSOs can be trusted to use deadly force. The Parnell administration has anticipated partially filling rural Alaska's law gap by expanding the VPSO program, but VPSOs aren't state employees. And the hesitation voiced by members of law enforcement is that the regional corporations employing them have insufficient officer standards. The program sees an annual turnover rate of 33% a year, which accounts for VPSOs leaving on their own as well as being fired for unacceptable or illegal conduct. SB 98's next stop is before the State Affairs Committee on Tuesday. In Nome, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The state's fisheries board wrapped up 2 weeks of meetings on Upper Cook Inlet commercial and sports fisheries late last week, and the dust is settling around the various user groups that have a stake in the fisheries. This session, management changes were approved for Kenai River early and late king runs and for the Central District Sockeye Management Plan. Supporters of the changes say that the new regulations are expected to allow more salmon, kings and coho specifically, to pass through the inlet into the northern district and into the river drainages of the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. Larry Engel is with the Matsu Borough's Fish and Wildlife Commission.
We hope to start making escapement goals on a regular basis, and once the runs get healthy, then we hope to be able to harvest and some of those too. We'd like to see us, you know, maximize the harvest of sockeye, which would be identified by achieving your escapement goals and staying within those, and then also pass numbers of fish north, both sockeye and coho. We're a salmon factory up there, but we're not getting enough product into our factories to produce fish, and that's what the board decided to move forward.
But those opposed to the changes say that commercial drift netters and set netters will be hurt and that they have suffered a disproportionate hit in fishing time and area. Paul Dale, president of the Kenai-based Alaska Salmon Alliance, says commercial fishers have taken a significant allocation shift, and ASA has issued a statement questioning the efficacy of the board process.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's time for the Healthy Futures Challenge. Pull out the jump ropes or go sledding with the family and get out and play. Get moving with activities the whole family enjoys. Find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. Healthy kids are happy kids. Inspire your kids to get out and play every day. For more ways to get active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, gives Alaska Native students the inspiration and opportunity to excel in science and engineering careers, building a sustainable future for Alaska. More at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
Airlift Northwest could bring back its popular membership program under legislation introduced in the Alaska House and Senate. The state's Division of Insurance last November told the company to discontinue its AirCare membership because it no longer met the letter of Alaska law. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander has more.
Airlift Northwest started the Alaska AirCare program in 2008. Nearly all of the more than 3,200 members are in Southeast, a third of them in Juneau. An emergency medical flight from Southeast Alaska to Seattle or Anchorage can cost $100,000 or more. Carla Hart purchased her membership about 4 years ago when she learned about the program through her doctor's office. She says she did some research and figured it was a no-brainer.
$100 to not have to worry if I'll have a financial hardship if I need a medevac.
A number of Hart's family and friends are also AirCare members, and so far, no one has had to use it. It's peace of mind, she says. AirCare is purchased by household, and one membership covers everyone living in a home. The cost is $100 a year. It's considered a supplement to other health insurance. Airlift Northwest Executive Director Chris Martin says the company has always been clear that AirCare is not an insurance program.
In most medical situations, insurance is billed and then there's a copay. What an AirCare membership guarantees you is that you have no out-of-pocket expenses or no copay. So we bill the insurance, we take what the insurance reimburses us. You, as our AirCare member, do not see a bill for any further services.
The AirCare program operates in Washington State as a nonprofit, and it was allowed to operate in Alaska under an exemption. Acting Insurance Director Marty Hester says Airlift Northwest was no longer considered a nonprofit when the company restructured under the University of Washington Medical School.
The program that they were offering was a transfer of risk, and that is the definition of insurance, when a risk is transferred from one person to another.
House Bill 300 and Senate Bill 159 should correct the problem. The legislation allows air ambulance providers to offer membership programs like AirCare and permits the insurance division to adopt regulations covering such programs. Representative Munoz's office worked with Hester on the legislation, but he wouldn't comment on the bill. She says she heard from a lot of constituents when they found out their supplemental plan was no longer good.
The legislation will reestablish the opportunity for companies like Airlift Northwest to provide a membership service to residents that wish to have that extra coverage for emergency transport.
Munoz says more than 1,300 Juneau residents have an AirCare membership, and many of them are senior citizens.
Certainly we live in an area that is somewhat isolated, and people, especially seniors and people facing difficult health situations, want this added assurance that they can get out safely and at a reasonable cost.
According to Airlift Northwest's Director Martin, Alaska is the only state in the U.S. that does not allow medevac services to offer a supplemental membership program to help defray the cost of an emergency medical flight. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
The U.S. Geological Survey says melting Beaufort sea ice is creating new habitat for geese on the North Slope. KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports.
For animals that live on Arctic ice like polar bears and walruses, rising sea temperatures usually mean a disappearing home. But John Pierce, a biologist for the U.S. Geological Survey in Anchorage, says that's not always the case.
We really don't know how all the different species of wildlife are going to respond to changes in the Arctic as a result of warming climates and diminishing sea ice, but folks often say there's likely going to be winners and losers.
The winners in this round, black brant geese. On the North Slope, the brant frequents inland waters like Teshekpuk Lake, which feeds a wetland system in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. A year ago, the Bureau of Land Management put together its first ever unified plan for managing both wildlife and resources in the petroleum reserve. They drew a line around the Teshekpuk area and closed most of it to oil and gas development. Some of it is technically open, but the BLM wouldn't lease it without extra consideration for the waterfowl and caribou that live there. In the meantime, the U.S. Geological Survey is watching to see how animals are using the wetlands, and John Pierce, their biologist, says he's noticed changes. Black brant are now flocking to a part of the Teshekpuk area where there didn't used to be food for them. That's changing as sea ice melts off and saltwater creeps further inland.
And that's causing more coastal flooding of these low-lying habitats and killing off the plants that are more used to freshwater and creating environments where saltwater-loving plants can grow.
Those environments are new coastal salt marshes, full of plants that the geese like to eat. The plants are growing faster than the black brant can crop them, meaning other species of goose and Arctic shorebird are also moving into the new marshes. These areas used to be home to caribou. Pierce says there's more than enough freshwater and grazing habitat for them further inland on the Teshekpuk parcel. And there's more than enough new marsh for the birds along the coastline. Pierce says they haven't filled it all up yet. Right now, many of the geese are staying at Teshekpuk Lake like they always have, or splitting their time between the lake and the coast. It's not clear what'll happen next. Pierce says he and other biologists have a lot of questions going forward.
If the storm surges continue to come inland, are these areas just going to be permanently flooded? Or as the permafrost continues to thaw underneath these habitats, are they going to sort of sink out of reach of the brant? And is there sort of a march of this habitat inland, or do we reach a point at which it can't extend any further inland?
All those dynamics, short and long term, are important to the Bureau of Land Management. They need data about where wildlife are and where they're going to make decisions about where it's safe to drill and build. Stacy McIntosh is the acting manager of the BLM's Arctic Field Office based in Fairbanks. She says they can't draw any major conclusions from the new information just yet. But McIntosh says she's taking it as a good sign that melting sea ice off the North Slope is creating habitat for a change.
There was an uncertainty as to what climate change may be doing to this area, whether or not it was going to respond positively or negatively.
One thing is sure, oil and gas leasing around Teshekpuk is never going to be popular with conservation groups, which have so far kept it undeveloped. The closest it's come was in 2006, when the Bush administration tried to open it for sale and lost the case to the Audubon Society and others in federal appeals court. In On Alaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Annie Ropeek in Unalaska. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Pat Yak is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
And by
Doy Unlimited, announcing the 2014 annual shareholder meeting on Friday, March 14th at the Westmark Hotel in Fairbanks. Information at doyon.com. Alaskans who experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, and mental health conditions are important members of the state's workforce. From healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants, Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages Alaska employers to consider ways in which Trust beneficiaries and their unique skills can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD. Paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov or on Facebook. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.